If this doesn't work out, what are you going to do? And if they have a pretty fulsome answer to that, I don't want to invest.
Yeah, that's
Because
right.
that means they're not really that committed. They're thinking
Have
about
you
what
burned the
they do.
ships, right?
They got to
Yeah.
burn the ships. They got to be fully committed.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast, where we give you a behind-the-scenes look at company building from the perspective of the builders themselves. This is how we operate.
Welcome to the Operate Podcast. I'm Kerry Ransom. Today's episode is sponsored by BankTech Ventures, the first strategic investment fund designed by the community banking industry for community bank innovation and investment. BankTech identifies leading products and technologies for community banks and works with the founders of those companies to maximize their impact in the community banking industry and for their businesses. If you're a bank looking to innovate and invest in the future, or a founder who wants to work with community banks, reach out to BankTech Ventures at banktechventures.com. My guest today is Michael Berman, founder and CEO of InContracts. InContracts has been around for about 15 years and has become very quickly the leading provider of proactive risk management software for the financial industry. They cover many areas, and a few would include things like vendor management, enterprise risk management, contracts, and compliance. Michael was an attorney inside a few companies before starting InContracts, and I think a lot of what drove him to start that was the opportunities he saw inside those as he worked on things like agreements and with vendors and in compliance. And so we'll talk about that as part of his story, as I want to hear it certainly from him. And I've really enjoyed getting to know Michael over the last couple of years and just appreciate him for that entrepreneurial journey. I know how hard it is to build the kind of software company and the kind of success that he has. And he has such an openness. He has a growth mindset. He's such an empowering and accessible leader. And I think I see it in the culture of his company and the people that work with him. And I also appreciate him, as we are both immersed in the financial industry, for his commitment to helping community banks like we try to and serve them. And so we just have so much to discuss. Michael, really happy to have you here. Thanks for joining me.
Well, Gary, thank you for having me. And certainly respect a lot of what BankTech Ventures does to support the banking community, and thrilled to be on your podcast.
Well, as I said, you know, you really embody the kind of leader that I have such great admiration and respect for. I most recently got to see it again at your recent user conference. So, you know, thank you again for inviting me and including us in it. I think it also seems to have infected your customers. I feel like you have such an engaged and passionate user group and customer base. What do you feel like you've done to cultivate that?
I think we are all really interested in solving similar problems. We understand the fact that we're overwhelmed by the number of compliance changes throughout the country that affect banking. And that's not just bank regulations. Those can be business regulations. They can be all sorts of things that affect our day-to-day, along with risk management. And risk management is ever present in everything bankers do. And we are committed to helping solve those challenges. They realize we care, we're in the trenches. We want to work shoulder to shoulder with them to help solve those problems. And we do that through our software. And one of the twists we've always had in our software is building knowledge as a service, which kind of goes back to demonstrate that we're building the data set into the system so that it's not just a place to do the work, but it's a place that has really useful information that's timely so that we can be part of that conversation.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I saw it. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I sat in on some of those breakout sessions and saw the collaboration and sharing amongst your customers. And, you know, one of the reasons why we even started BankTech Ventures was this idea of, can you create more of this consortium collaboration environment? You know, we use the term better together a lot. And I felt like I saw that amongst your customers at your conference. And it was so inspiring to me as you think about encouraging banks, because I think a lot of senior bank leaders maybe don't embody that collaboration like maybe their teams do. What advice do you have for them about how to do more of that?
We talk in contracts a lot about buyer personas and who our ultimate end user customers are. And it's easier, quite frankly, to collaborate if you're in risk management and compliance or legal than if you're a loan officer. And when I'm a loan officer, I'm competing against other financial institutions for a loan. And I understand that those are going to be different cultures. And so we really have been very committed to our buyer persona, our user groups that allow for this type of collaboration, because bank down the street went through an exam, we're going through an exam. If we can collaborate on how we can best go through exams together, we're going to all be better off as a community than if we're trying to compete about what the regulators really are looking for in an examination process.
That makes sense. I think I still like the idea of challenging the loan officers, the CEOs to say, look, you have competition, but
sure,
it's everywhere. It's not just the other community bank in your area. You have the big banks, you have non-banks. So more banks being efficient and effective, to your point, benefits everybody.
I wholeheartedly agree. I just think it's a faster rate with some areas than it is with others to get that type of collaboration.
Yeah.
But we're thrilled by the client base and we're thrilled with the feedback we get. And we want to foster that. We do that both virtually, we do it via forums like our user conference where we have people live together, and we do it in product. So there's all sorts of fun ways we can really engage our clients in the risk and compliance process.
Yeah, I totally could see that. And it felt it when I was there, that kind of co-creation with them was very clearly a part of your event, but it felt very much part of your culture too.
It is. And one of the challenges everybody faces, to give you an example of that, cloud computing, which now we consider old technology, but if we just look back at how the regulators dealt with that, it really started to take hold in the early 2000s with Azure and AWS. And we got guidance from the regulators about how to risk assess that in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time. And so already people are adopting things like AI-based solutions. There's no guidance about that. So what are we to do? And we can't wait. And so we are able to generate best practices for risk assessing banking as a service, artificial intelligence. The regulators last week, maybe it was this week, put out some guidance on buy now, pay later. We're able to take that and immediately start carving up this content into a model that shows up in the software. Mm-hmm. So if I'm implementing buy now, pay later, I have a guide for a risk assessment without having to source through other means, or it may not fit. And it gives me options to customize it to my institution. So it in and of itself becomes a collaboration tool.
Yeah, great examples. Well, it seems like, and partly this year in banking, and we can certainly talk about that in a bit, but it seems like because this has been sort of a wild year in banking, compliance and risk are really having a renewed focus. I feel like it has kind of come back. And so as you think about the challenges ahead for your customers, you mentioned some of these changes, whether it's the emergence of AI or just new regulations, how do you think about your responsibility to continue to help them?
Right. Well, from my vantage point, risk and compliance never left the building.
It's always been there. Yeah,
it may not have had the spotlight from time to time, but it never goes away. Mm-hmm. I think investing in technology to help us do it differently, help us do it better, is going to be the key. This traditional mindset in banking in particular, where we're just going to throw people at it, and they don't really need software, they don't really need tools, is a path to failure. Because no matter how many people you have, the data sets are too big, the regulations are too much, you can't do this the manual way anymore because of all those challenges people face. And so by getting knowledge as a service by having automation built in. That future, we're in a highly regulated industry. And if you want to operate on a lean basis, you better not just have great personnel, you also have to have really great systems in place that allow you to leverage those people to execute your business plan. And that's where automating the back office is going to be a key process for financial institutions to be able to thrive in this environment.
Absolutely. Well, and you kind of, intimated it when you talk about efficiency, just throwing bodies and cost. It just feels like there is an increasing amount of oversight for sure. And therefore, in general, that translates to generally higher cost. And so there are definitely people out there that speculate smaller banks just can't handle this. And it's almost like the big banks welcome it as a competitive advantage opportunity. How do you think about that? Can small banks even afford to compete anymore?
Well, they've got to spend their money differently if they're going to compete. And that means automating this back office, being more thoughtful about what kind of products and services they want to offer, and understanding that bringing on a vendor, whether that vendor is going to offer, I'll just continue to pick on buy now, pay later, or some other commercial product or whatever it might be, what are all the costs associated with that, which include things like vendor management and risk assessments and compliance, so that it's all baked into their thought process instead of we're going to try and be like the big banks and do everything. You can't afford to do everything. But we can be really good at a few things. And I always am admiring these community bankers that are able to thrive in this environment with focus. And that's the continual item that we see, that what makes some community bankers really successful where others aren't quite as successful. It's their focus. Their vision is extremely clear. Their team knows what they're trying to do. And everything's wrapped into that. And then that allows them to have more resources to execute against that plan. And we love the opportunity to be a part of that and helping them succeed.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just amazed by some of these folks. And the words that I think the last few years have certainly brought forth for me when I think about the successful community banks is resilience and adaptability. Because they have that clear focus, they're prepared for almost any scenario. And we've seen some wild scenarios in just the last few years.
Sure. And we're going to see more. I mean, that's the challenge ahead is going anywhere. Who would have predicted what happened this year?
That's right.
I don't think anybody really did. And yet we're still here. Community banking still thriving. Banks are still making money. And the demand's still there from clients. And so it's a really resilient industry. And as much as technology creates threats, it also creates tremendous opportunities to rethink how we can do things differently in the back office.
That's right. Well, to your point on this year, it's been a wild year with Silicon Valley Bank and interest rate changes. And even, you mentioned Bass earlier, some of these consent orders that have come out in some cases, maybe from a year or two ago, but still coming to the forefront. Any things you feel like you and your team have learned from just the events of this year beyond just we're going to continue to see more things we may not predict?
Well, I think there's been a regulatory shift. And as much as people don't like to publicize that, as much as I think it should be publicized, regulators are looking at banking as a service differently than they did a couple of years ago. And bankers need to be aware of that. And this is where the community can have a tremendous impact, because when we know, hey, if you're going to do this type of relationship, these are the things we need to do differently from a due diligence standpoint, from a risk assessment standpoint, that can be extremely useful in your business case or how you're thinking about going into a new market. Bass is harder to describe because there's so many variations of it. I'm going to shift your example slightly to FTX and cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. With the collapse of FTX, the risk that not only examiners, but bankers thought about crypto shifted radically, very quickly, to much more risk averse. To last fall, there were a lot of bankers who were like, how do I get involved in cryptocurrency? What vendors do I want to use? I need to be in that market to I don't want to have anything to do with cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. So I think those things are appropriate. And it's also when we're in a new market to make sure that you've got the appropriate risk and controls. You can't outsource the judgment of risk. And that comes up over and over again, no matter what industry, what bankers are trying to do. We always still own that piece of the puzzle and need to make sure that we're not over-indexing because it's an exciting space.
That's right. I think that's such a very, very valid point. And, you know, I think, as you know, I got into this fintech world about a decade ago on the fintech partnering with banks side. And right. One of the things that I felt like we were always very clear-headed about is we have to think like the bank from the risk and compliance side and almost mirror a lot of the functions, because if that relationship gets into trouble because of risk and compliance, that could shut our whole business down. And so we sort of need each other. It's felt like in the last few years, some have taken their eye off of that ball. And I sort of, you know, I know a lot of banks will pause getting into BaaS if they haven't gotten into it, but yet it still feels like it is an opportunity if people think about, hey, we can apply risk and compliance standards universally. Let's not, this shouldn't give us any change there. The business success of these partners, in my mind, could vary, but that doesn't have to create risk. The business risk is going to be there. Apply the compliance standards and expectations consistently.
But the key is you're applying it as a banker, risk and compliance standards, not yet another vendor who you really don't understand what they're doing. That's right. Like, you got to own the judgment. Now, that does not mean you can't use vendors, and there are tons of great vendors out there to manage things that we don't do, just to be mm-hmm. clear.
Sure.
Like BSA OFAC compliance. Mm-hmm. Yes, but you're still in judgment of the data you get back from those systems. You don't have to do everything yourself, much like you don't have to go through every charge somebody's done on a credit report. That would be a waste of everybody's time. But you know, you're still making a credible judgment on the information that you're getting. And that's where you need that level of support so that you've got the appropriate judgments in place. But I don't think banking as a service is dead by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to be handled differently with greater risk and controls. So the safety of our banking system's really going to be protected from this. And it's not the Wild West. There are a lot of technology people that I've met who have zero interest in risk and compliance. They view it as a barrier, something evil. And hey, if we break some laws along the way, that's okay. We'll clean it up later. And that's just not the banking culture that's out there. And if people want to do that, leave that to the big banks and they can take the big risks. For community banking, we need to stay far away from that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and I think to your point, I mean, the role I see you guys obviously playing increasingly for those banks that are doing BaaS are third-party risk management, and even fourth-party, right? It's like, I think of myself, especially now on the work I do at BankTech Ventures, if I'm helping a bank, having also been on the fintech side, hey, you need to understand the infrastructure that they have entirely, because you do bear at least some of that risk as well. And that clearly puts you guys in a very significant role to play.
But even traditional vendor management is still a challenge for many of these institutions, because there's some big players in our space like FIS, Jack Henry, and Fiserv that all really have huge departments that are trying to do the right thing. When you start going beyond that, now we have other vendors, and those other vendors may or may not have the resources to do all the right things. And just last week, the NCUA put out a release that 60 credit unions had been shut down from a ransomware attack caused by one vendor. And that one vendor hadn't had controls for security awareness training. And I assume everybody might know what that is, but that's that training to make sure you don't click on bad links and investor systems. This vendor didn't have all their employees do that. This vendor also didn't have any way to verify with people that they work with. They did background checks on their employees. So that's just two controls you can have for ransomware, because at the end of the day, that's the employee threat. And if people aren't paying attention to those things, you can wind up with a vendor who's not doing those. And all of a sudden, you've created a massive amount of risk for your organization, and that data exists. We can make judgments off of that. And that's where we can help institutions really be far more informed.
Great points. Well, just kind of put a final pin in this kind of year in banking. Any changes that you feel like you or your company have made to your strategy or business operations because of this year?
We continue to evolve our, what I call our content, based on things that have happened throughout the year. And so we meet every month about what the regulators are doing. Mm-hmm. So that continues to pivot.
Have you had to speed that up?
We have. We used to meet quarterly, and now it's monthly. So that is definitely an acceleration. The size of the team continues to improve. We internally use AI to look at regulations on a state, federal, what's coming, to filter that information so that we're able to create better content for our clients. And then we also have the new advantage of the feedback from our clients. With over 4,000 institutions across the country, we get tremendous amounts of feedback that we can also incorporate into that loop, that we are working hard trying to figure out how to speed it up. Mm-hmm. But what makes it very strange when the regulators put out their semi-annual guidance or what they're focused on, you'd think that it's like a Super Bowl event in our company because everybody's all over it the day it comes out, trying to figure out what does this change something and how do we get this back out to our clients so that they're really aware and it's going to be helpful to them as they prepare for 2024 and moving forward. So there's more to come on that, but nothing that would be like earth-shattering as far as this year goes, other than banking as a service, massive changes in how people are viewing that, and a huge focus on third-party risk management that's been intensified as a result of what I mentioned before, ransomware attacks and other types of issues that are affecting vendors.
Mm-hmm. Well, the knowledge as a service aspect, I mean, really that to me is a brilliant business strategy. And you have this kind of collective knowledge community where there's network effects to that. And it's beautiful, Michael. I mean, I'm so excited because I think, you know, you've built something that continues to increase in value and has that durability to it. And obviously others have seen that as well. I mean, you brought on a growth equity partner a few years ago. And for, you know, my entrepreneurs in the audience that I'm sure always are keen to understand that, you know, the first time you've brought on a partner like this as an entrepreneur, what has that meant to you and your company to have a partner like that on board?
Well, I think if you don't mind, I will indulge here for a minute.
Sure.
And go back and tell it from the beginning to now for all those entrepreneurs out there. So when I worked at a fintech company as general counsel, the way I got into risk and compliance was the regulators are coming. They determined the company was a quote service provider. That's a loaded regulatory term, meaning you're going to get examined. And compliance now reports to legal, figure it out. So I used this amazing piece of software you may have heard of to do risk, compliance, vendor management, business continuity called Microsoft Excel.
Yes.
And it was super painful. And so after staying up for what felt like years, but it was only like a couple of months, we got through our exam. And I thought there's got to be a better way out there to do this than Excel. And so I started talking to people I knew in banking, other lawyers, risk managers. They're like, yeah, we use Excel. And I couldn't believe nobody had built anything to help with this. And so I started looking for something to buy. And what I found out in the marketplace was you can replace Excel with another bigger, better database, but that really didn't solve the problem. I wanted to know what the answers were to my questions and how you're supposed to do these things. And there really wasn't anything. So that company got sold, took my winnings from that and a bunch of angel investors and started In Contracts now in 2009. And focused originally, hence the name of the company, that we were going to build contract management inside vendor management, mm-hmm. which no one really had at the time. So that's the name in contracts. And of course, we grew way beyond that. And so we get to about 2015, and between 14 and 15, we doubled the size of the company from a revenue standpoint. But I have no management. I'm out of resources. I've mortgaged my house from the company. There's nothing left for me to give. And the growth is starting to kill me. It's Sunday night and I'm implementing clients because there's nobody left to do it. So I realized I got to do something. So that's when I brought in private equity firm number one. That was Mainsail Partners. And Mainsail is a very founder-friendly firm. And they asked me, Michael, this is great. We love it. How do we grow it by 10 times? What do you want to do? And I had a vision for a GRC company focused on this space of financial technology or financial services, that we could build all the content into the system, not just do vendor management, but do knowledge as a service. That's where that kind of started. And then 5 years later, we'd done all the things. We'd hit the targets. We're 10 times bigger than we were. And they're like, you're ready to graduate. And now we're on our second private equity firm, which is Griffin. And we are also still very rapidly growing. And the best thing about working with Griffin and Mainsail for that matter was the professional teams that were brought along to consult with us, because we've never grown to this size. I've never run a company this big. And so having people who are, oh, when I was at this stage, moving to this stage, this is what finance need to look like. This is what HR needs to look like. You need to be thinking about these things, because these things are decisions that could become blockers to growth if you don't figure this out now. And then, you know, we've had some added complications like a hybrid work environment and some other things that we've had to work our way through. But Griffin's been a phenomenal partner to help us navigate those growth hurdles while sticking to the core mission of knowledge as a service. And we're not going outside the financial services area. This is where we want to live.
Very cool. Well, as you think about that vision, because I know that you have and continue to probably even expand your vision, what can you share as kind of what do the next few years look like from your perspective?
So we're expanding a couple of really fascinating ways. The first one's AI. We think AI is the future of risk, compliance, and vendor management. We incorporated some already into our internal processes, which I've already described. We are launching our first ever product that's client facing, that is contract management, which kind of goes to our name as well, where the system will automatically read agreements and be able to tell you what's in those agreements, both from a business standpoint, like renewal dates, price increases, and control data. Does it have the appropriate subcontracting language? Does it have without a human, and give you kind of an evaluation of that? Is this good? Is this not so good? This really needs to be looked at. This is a big problem. So that we're launching on January 15th. So I'm very excited about that. And we're going to continue to use and revolutionize how people think about business continuity, risk assessments with AI. So that's a piece of the puzzle. The other thing we've launched is education. So one of the biggest challenges with our workforce is, how do we train people to do this? So we launched a certification course in vendor management. We have other certifications that we plan to launch, so that we're reaching further down into the organizations of financial institutions, so that they become knowledgeable about these subject areas and become certified in them. And we're working on partnering with bank associations and other financial institution organizations, so that we can work with them together to market these programs to bankers, so that it becomes part of the industry.
Do you even think about taking that into schools potentially and other, you know,
talent? We haven't gone that far yet. It's really focused on what we call adult learning. Okay. And we brought in institutional designers for adult learning, things of that nature, because most people that we run into, they've got a job and then somehow got into compliance or risk management. Wasn't their first choice maybe, but now they're there and they want to learn. And so we think that there's just a tremendous amount of demand for something that's interactive and not just another webinar where you sit there and get lectured to and you know, that's a much harder learning environment. And so we want to make it easier.
Very cool. Well, let's go a little deeper on AI as a software company. And you talked about how you're incorporating it into your product. You know, one of the things, having been in and around software for as much of my career as I have, is old code is old code. And sometimes it can persist for a long time. Sometimes it needs to be completely re-architected and rewritten. And you're now in that decade plus software company. How do you think about AI as maybe an opportunity to do some of that better? And even as a threat, as you think about sometimes the new entrant into a market has a cleaner, more modern architecture code base. And how do you think about that now as an incumbent?
I think we've got to continually reinvest in the software. We on purpose built it to be modular because we know a community bank or a smaller financial institution, they're not going to buy a system that does 18 things for their back office. They can't implement it, quite frankly, because they don't have the personnel and the bandwidth to change all things dealing with risk, compliance, and vendor management at once. So almost by design, because we built it that way, it also gives us the opportunity to reinvest in modules, rewrite retire old code. And while we're doing it, well, let's make it all AI-based to begin with from the beginning. And so we can modernize all of that. Luckily for us, I think institutions are utilitarian by design. They care far more about what it's going to do necessarily than it looking like it's the newest code base or the latest, I should say, user interface. Misspoke there, but that isn't always because we're not a consumer-facing solution set. We're B2B, I think is helpful as we think those things through. But that's the way we're approaching it. And it's software as a service as well, which means you got to constantly reinvest in the software if you want to have happy clients. And luckily, that is a key mantra for us. We want to make sure the clients are getting what they need.
Absolutely. Well, let's go a little deeper there, Michael. I haven't really given you much of an opportunity right now to talk about success stories. I mean, I've seen firsthand your clients are happy. One of the ways you obviously benchmark that is by really seeing that software in action in their business. So give me a couple examples of how banks have really leveraged some of your products to improve different operations or efficiencies, or really found that ROI from working with you.
I can think of a couple of different ways. The first is what I would call time savings.
Sure.
So risk assessments used to be what a lot of bankers do if they have a completely manual process. I'll borrow the bank next door's risk assessment. The last bank I went to had a risk assessment, or I got a form from somebody. And it's a one-size-fits-all approach to information security. Well, that typically leads to a bunch of stuff that isn't applicable. If you've seen these things, they're giant lists of questions. And for those of you who might be more into investment banking, think of it like a giant due diligence list. And having a one size fits all for every situation probably isn't the best use. So within our software for risk assessments, which we know are now regulators want everything to have a risk assessment, being able to easily tailor that to your business needs is something that you can do in the admin section, which means every employee has less work to do. Even better, by linking the control across risk assessments, you can have one person do something and it persists throughout all of the risk assessments instead of having eight people do the same work. So relatively basic examples, but very key to that time savings piece from a risk assessment standpoint. There's also the opportunity to reduce real risk. What do I mean by that? I'll pick on vendor management again, because that is a huge focus for the regulators. But knowing that I've got a vendor that's got a real problem and I need to do something about it. I need to build my contingency plan. I'm going to get away from this now and put them over here. And then that vendor, within a few months, they've had a data breach. They've had a real problem that's affecting other institutions that didn't do that. and you've saved millions of dollars now because you've avoided that attack. And I don't want to get too specific into individual vendors or banks for obvious reasons, but we see that play out typically on a quarterly basis at this point. So that's a huge opportunity. It's like not having a firewall or not having antivirus software at this point, because those things need to be at your vendors. And if you're not paying attention to what your vendors are doing, it creates a huge threat. And then the third one that I'd bring up is compliance. So in compliance, we sell a solution that keeps bankers in real time what's going on with new regulations. And not only what the change was, but what policies of mine does that affect? So I need to update my policies. And what did I do to implement that throughout my organization? So unfortunately, people don't pay attention to this until it starts to bite them. And you can use simple things like they changed the flood insurance risk tables and you saw all the people who got written up for that. Well, that also continues to move its way forward for all sorts of regulations where we see our clients able to now identify, implement, document that they implemented it. And the ones that didn't are the ones that are being written up for hundreds of thousands of dollars, far more than the cost of any of this software. And they're saving significant money, pain from findings as a result of that. So those are three ways. There are more, but I will pause.
Yeah, great, great examples. Thank you for sharing those. One that I want to just go a little deeper into is you think about all of these industry vendors, right? I mean, we've cultivated a really exciting partnership with a lot of the startups that we are ultimately evaluating and investing in. And we're having great success using your software to help us with our diligence process, with housing that information, and then trying to make that more broadly available to our banks. And so as you think about knowledge as a service, do you think that collective knowledge and experience of institutions with third parties outside is something that you'll continue to delve into? Do you think that network is a network to help?
It is. It gets a little complicated. So one of the reasons it gets complicated is the vendors have a unique need to kind of keep some of this information technology, their security confidential.
Sure.
They also have a need to keep some of their financial information confidential. They don't want all of that to be public. And they certainly don't want how they do pen testing and the details of that to be public. So at the exact same time, bankers want to share once they've done their analysis of these things. And so that's kind of the push and the pull. And so we continually try and think about what data could we help leverage to get into the industry so people are aware. But I'm always fascinated that even the most basic things like this vendor's been breached, there are lawsuits about this vendor being breached, and we come to a brand new financial institution, find out not only are they still working with the vendor, they had no idea the breach even happened.
Yeah.
And so we've got to figure out the basics, but then on a more advanced level, how can we better share control data while preserving the needs that the vendor has and fulfilling the needs that the bank has to understand the security better? And it's getting better. We're seeing it evolve. But right now, we still see basic information, what controls we're looking at. And we've got to get people are hung up still on, well, I got a SOC 2 report from them, therefore it's okay. That's like saying I got an audit, no one read it, and it's okay. No loan officer would ever say, I didn't read the financial data. You got to have people who really understand that stuff. And that's probably not enough right now. There's additional information beyond that that the vendor has that can help make it a much more fulsome picture of what their information security is.
Well, that's also where I think AI has a real role to play, as you talked about earlier, because you can't, especially in a smaller bank, you can't have people that are experts in everything. So some of this is about how do you create collective capability.
Right. And that's what we do. So we are doing that as a service for our clients, reviewing all that information, serving it up to them so they can make fully informed decisions. And that's like, going back to how they save money. That's a way they save money.
Huge.
Because now I avoided this bad vendor. I was able to solve this problem at this vendor. And I now know what risks I'm taking. It's very hard as a community bank to operate if you're flying blind and you have no idea what risks you're taking.
That's right. Oh, thank you. Great discussion. So I want to turn for the last few minutes we have together, talk a little bit more about you. You know, you, as you said earlier, you started your career as a lawyer, general counsel in several companies. Now you're an entrepreneur. You know, were there entrepreneurial tendencies that as you look back that you had earlier in life before this journey?
I think I'd always really admired entrepreneurs. I admired people who built businesses. I was always fascinated with how they did that and reading books about how they did that. And my favorite legal experiences were working with entrepreneurs and being able to help them navigate the law. How do I set up my company? How do I finance my company? And what those options are. And so that was always really exciting for me. And I luckily was more and more as I got older, hanging out with people who were successful entrepreneurs who were, you should go do this, Michael. It sounds like this is something you want to do. And it was. And so I'm really thrilled that I took that plunge. But I also was glad I waited a little bit because I learned so much from these other entrepreneurs along the way when I was practicing law, and still have a good network of people that I think have really helped in that process.
Mm-hmm. Would you do it again?
Absolutely. I cannot imagine not operating a business. And if somebody bought in contracts and I wasn't running in contracts anymore, not that I have any desire for that, I can't imagine not going out and starting something new.
Yeah, I can relate. Once you've done it, it sort of becomes a just a part of, I don't know how to be any other way. So I totally get that. One of the things I often find, I mean, obviously amazing success in your first venture. That is not typical. Clearly you have to have some rituals or disciplines or things that have been useful to you. Any of those that you had before starting in contracts that you feel like helped you, and then any that you've adopted along the way that have helped you continue?
I actually think I work better and more effectively now than I ever did as a lawyer. Law, it's very time driven. It's client driven. Now I get to define all that stuff for myself. So I'm a morning person. I've gone from running to my Peloton or back and forth every day. I get up early. I like having my work time before what I would call discussions, meetings, where you're really not going to be able to have that focus time. And then I block time all over the place. So I make appointments with myself to work on problems so they don't get to fester. I make lists relentlessly. And then one of the more challenging things for many entrepreneurs is you can make the list of all the things and then you have to ruthlessly prioritize. Because you can get overwhelmed easily. And so one of the few things you're going to get done today, no matter what, before you go to sleep, is a very useful tactic in entrepreneurship.
Very helpful. Thank you for sharing. The other thing I would say, and I've kind of mentioned this, but I mean, you've made it farther than 99% of other software founders, right? You're in that rarefied air in both your revenue traction, the fact that you've attracted outside capital and growth capital like you have, the time in market, all these various dimensions. As you look back, and I think you now probably get counsel sought from a number of founders, what advice do you have for people just starting out? They're building their product, maybe trying to get their first customer or two.
Test, experiment, that's super helpful, but you've got to be absolutely committed. I mean, one of the things that I find when people and I ask this question, because now I'm in a position where people ask me, hey, you'd be an angel investor in this.
Sure.
And I didn't realize that this was a loaded question when it was being asked of me, but now I realize it is. So, Kerry, if this doesn't work out, what are you going to do? And if they have a pretty fulsome answer to that, I don't want to invest.
Because
that means they're not really that committed. They're thinking
Burned the ships, right?
Yeah. They got to burn the ships. They got to be fully committed to it because it's going to take everything they have in order to make it. Because there's going to be some challenge they haven't thought of that's going to threaten the entirety of the enterprise that they're going to have to overcome. And it's tough. It's really tough.
It is tough. But yes, what a journey. And you know, as you no doubt have shared. You learn so much about yourself through it as well. Well, Michael, this has been so fun, as I knew it would be. Final question for this conversation. What are you most excited about over the next year as you look ahead?
I'm really excited to see our investments in AI get out into the marketplace. I think that's going to be great. I think I'm excited to see how banks adapt to this new environment that we're in. And I think that continued expansion of technology for the back office, and now that there is a bit more emphasis on it, should be a boon for everybody involved. Risk can be an advantage. And I think more and more bankers are paying attention that I can turn this into the way I'm going to differentiate myself. And that's really exciting to see. So we've got some big plans for the next year, further investments. And so just as excited as I was on day one to see where we can go within contracts.
Well, Mike, it's so awesome. Thank you for joining me. I'm so appreciative of your time and your willingness to share. And as I said earlier, for your leadership in this banking technology industry. I mean, we need more entrepreneurs like you that are committed to helping banks continue on this journey. And I so appreciate the partnership. And I think, together we are going to continue to really drive more positive impact. So thank you again, and look forward to continuing to build the relationship we have as well.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, Kerry, and appreciate working with Bank Tech Ventures. Look forward to talking with you soon.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Operate Podcast. If you like this conversation, as a favor to me, you can rate us, review us, or subscribe, or tell your friends. You can also reach out to us on Twitter @Operate Podcast. Until next week, get out there and operate.